Welcome everyone to another episode of the Damage Report. I'm John Adirola. Big three guest show twice in 1 week. Three guests. We got awesome guests coming in though to talk about education, to talk about the heartbeat bills. I don't like that name, but that's what they're referred to. That are sweeping through southern states. We're gonna be talking about Pete Buttigieg and a really interesting case that he could have had a positive impact on while he was mayor and did not. We're gonna have a reporter joining us to talk about that. We're going to close out the show with Harriet Tubman and Steve Mnuchin. Two names you don't often hear in the same sentence, and Steve Mnuchin would like to keep it that way. And lots of great stuff that we're going to get to, but we've got a massive story that we've got to talk about right off the bat, and so I'm just going to jump right into it. If you are watching a screen and you hear facial recognition, it's likely that you're watching something like Black Mirror and not the news. Even though facial recognition technology is incredibly important and in terms of your rights, scary in a couple of different ways. Now, you might think, okay, facial recognition, I know that your camera can identify you on like Instagram, they can see your face or whatever, but how important could this possibly be? Well, it's actually spreading all over the place. And as I list these examples of places that are already using facial recognition, I want you to remember one fact. And that is that, and this is crazy, there is virtually no law in America regulating the use of facial recognition in virtually any setting. It is the Wild West, actually more unregulated than the Wild West when it comes to this. So where can you find facial recognition technology? Or where might you be scanned by it and not even know that you're finding it? A Ticketmaster-owned company will soon test facial recognition to get people into events faster. In other words, a person could theoretically upload an image of their face onto an app and then go right into the event without stopping for a ticket scan or potentially a security check, unless they're accidentally identified as a criminal and they just get tackled by some guard that they never saw coming. It's already being used in 17 international airports, among them Atlanta, New York City, Boston, San Jose, Chicago, and two airports in Houston. Many major airlines are on board with the idea, including Delta, JetBlue, British Airways, Lufthansa, and American Airlines. So from entertainment to air travel, you've got US Customs and Border Protection already using facial recognition technology at Lindbergh Field to scan international arrivals. So you've got it there too, government getting involved. The San Diego Police Department uses a mobile facial recognition device to confirm identities during certain arrests. And so these are sort of relatively official uses of it, but it's gonna be used in so many casual cases as well. Take a look, BuzzFeed News had a write up about thousands of stores which will soon use facial recognition and they won't need your consent because as we've already covered, there's no laws governing virtually any of this. But that's not to say that there aren't consequences for its use and not widespread across the entire population evenly. Certain groups are going to find that the widespread use of facial recognition technology is going to be a gigantic pain in their ass. And we're gonna be talking about exactly why that is. So why is this finally in the news? Well, it's because the Congress was talking to some experts on facial recognition technology, especially as companies like Amazon and Google are pushing ahead with plans to experiment and monetize these technologies more and more. Thankfully though, there are some people in government that are concerned with your privacy, the implications of facial recognition, including Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who had questions about the right to privacy in this area.
Mr. Ferguson, one of the prime constitutional concerns about the non-consensual use of facial recognition technology is rooted or alluded to in the 14th Amendment, correct?
That's correct, it's one of them.
And right now, companies, governments, agencies can essentially steal or use your biometric data from you without your consent. And this is outrageous, right? Because this is America and we have a right to privacy. Isn't that right, Ms. Colaiani?
That's absolutely right.
And Ms. Colaiani, what was the Supreme Court case that identified the right to privacy?
It's been, I don't remember the original one, but I mean, there's been a series of cases where the court has essentially said, look, with modern technology, it shouldn't mean that we don't have Fourth Amendment rights.
Yes.
And think about how much data can be being harvested just as you are walking through an airport or through a store or at an event. Many cameras, some of which you might not even be aware of there, are tracking you and they are learning. They're learning things about your face, your body movements. They're analyzing people talking and they're gathering all of that data. And there is no opt-in or opt-out. You have no say over this. How much can be stored, what uses it can be put to. None of that is regulated. at all. And that is not to say that it's not being used. And there are tons of innovations in this area, some of which you might end up enjoying in their practical applications. But there's a lot of it that we should be very scared about. And the government is just barely getting started in inquiring into this. And if you've seen congressional testimony of people like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, and you've seen the caliber of questions that most politicians send to tech executives, do you really feel that they are up to the task of understanding all the implications and all the ways that this technology will be used? I'm not really confident about that. So AOC clearly is worried about that. And what's interesting there is that she got a good answer to her question in that first clip that we played you, but that's not actually what she was getting at. And she alludes to the point that she was hoping to get into in this clip.
With relation to the 14th Amendment, it was Roe v. Wade that established the right to privacy. Is that correct?
Roe v. Wade, the right to privacy was addressed there as well.
Right, so, you know, we don't just have, because that right to privacy is alluded to part of the case in our right to privacy, is that this doesn't just give us a right to my uterus, it gives me a right to my hand and my shoulders, my heads, my knees, my toes, and my face. And so in some ways, part of the case, although it's not all of it, there's a great deal rooted in the 14th Amendment with search and seizure, but in our right to privacy, we also see here that this is about our entire body, our right to our entire body. And the similar principle that keeps a legislator out of my womb is the same principle that would keep Facebook and algorithms off of all of our faces.
Now, that is a fascinating point that she made at the end there, but it is purely speculative. It's purely hypothetical because courts have not actually ruled on this. I think that the argument that she's making there makes a ton of sense if we do have a right to privacy with certain body parts. I think that the far more casual exploitation of the rest of our body should also be protected. But as of right now, again, purely hypothetical. We have no idea how the Supreme Court would end up coming down in this area. And I should say specifically, we have no idea how Donald Trump's Supreme Court, which is obviously incredibly deferential to the desires of corporations, corporations that are going to be exploiting this information that they are freely gathering all over the country. How would they rule? We don't know, but we might find out at some point, especially as larger and larger corporations start to roll out technology based on these sorts of practices. And the issue too is, it's one thing to finally have the government start to inquire about this and perhaps have some sorts of regulations. That seems like it would be progress. But do you really feel comfortable with years or possibly decades of data gathering going on and then have the government come in at the end? Is that really a safe spot for us? Do we really believe that Google and Amazon and Facebook and all of these organizations, or Ticketmaster, or you know, Hot Topic, all of these places that are using cameras to gather your data, that they're going to just willingly eject that information? Either the raw data or the algorithms and things like that that they have generated from all of that data gathering. Are we confident about that too? I'm certainly not. And so by the time the Supreme Court actually rules on this, by the time the government actually provides some sort of guidance on what is acceptable and what is not in terms of taking your visual data when you're just going about your day, it might at that point be too late. It might not be possible to put the genie back in the lamp at that point. And a lot of this, of course, I think is very important concerns about privacy. But in terms of how it's being exploited, it is, again, hypothetical. But there are areas where this is already having a drastically negative impact on people's lives. And that's when we get into the topic of racial discrimination in technology like AI, but specifically here in facial recognition. Now, I'm gonna show you a clip, fascinating clip, and I'm gonna give you some stats. But I want you to bear in mind that a couple of months ago, AOC brought up that topic about how AI and these sorts of algorithms can be racially discriminatory, and she was roundly mocked on social media and on Fox News for bringing that up, because the people who are mocking her have literally never thought about the fact that people who look like me generating these algorithms might have a bias towards that sort of presentation or that sort of information. And so she was talking with Joy Buell-Lemwini, and here is what they got into.
We saw that these algorithms are effective to different degrees. So are they most effective on women?
No.
Are they most effective on people of color?
Absolutely not.
Are they most effective on people of different gender expressions?
No, in fact, they exclude them.
So what demographic is it mostly effective on?
White men.
And who are the primary engineers and designers of these algorithms?
Definitely white men.
So We have a technology that was created and designed by one demographic that is only mostly effective on that one demographic, and they're trying to sell it and impose it on the entirety of the country.
So we have the pale male data sets being used as something that's universal when that isn't actually the case when it comes to representing the full sepia of humanity.
And do you think that this could exacerbate the already egregious inequalities in our criminal justice system?
It already is.
And she went on to expound on a number of cases where this has already happened. And for some people who... this facial recognition technology is sort of just a curiosity, or it might be used in, I don't know, like expediting your Ticketmaster purchase or something like that, making it so you don't have to take out your phone and show a picture or something like that. It might seem like, well, how bad could it be? But think about all the different instances, not just in stores in the mall, but in airports or in, customs and border protection, or when a police department is using it, where you want to be correctly identified. And this technology is not up to the task of actually identifying who you are, or perhaps even more scary, when it misidentifies you as someone that you definitely do not want to be identified as. And this is where we get into areas that are not hypothetical at all. We are already seeing these sorts of errors being incredibly common. People are being arrested because it falsely believes that they are criminals. And that is, again, that's not evenly distributed across the... the color spectrum. These sorts of apps are tested on databases that have vastly overrepresented white faces. And so they are more accurate in identifying those faces. False positives are far more common for people who are not white, not male, and all of that. And take a look at an experiment that was actually done. This is not in the US, but still very interesting. Facial recognition technology has misidentified members of the public as potential criminals in 96% of scans so far in London, new figures reveal. That is the product of trials that cost literally hundreds of thousands of pounds. And I mean, that's a pretty bad error rate. I understand that this is like, I guess, a beta test or whatever. But if you're talking about the difference between being arrested and not arrested, I would like a better success rate than 4%, I think. I don't think that that's too much to ask for. So again, we have multiple concerns here. We have the already established racial discrimination aspect of facial recognition. And then also a lot of concerns that we're only starting to understand in terms of how big businesses and governments will end up using this technology and this data that they're freely gathering right now. And in that area, I just want to read one more quote from Representative AOC, who said, tied to the political reality that there is a global rise in authoritarianism and fascism, I don't want to see an authoritarian surveillance state, whether it's run by a government or whether it's run by five corporations. And in the end, looking ahead to a few decades from now, having competition between as many as five corporations might end up being sort of wishful thinking. It might be smaller than that. And as we see more and more right-wing governments being elected around the world, we had that in India just last night. How comfortable do you feel with the current hands-off approach that the government and the Supreme Court have with what corporations are doing with your visual information? For me, I am deeply uncomfortable. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We come back. The first of our three guests are going to be joining us to talk about a national day of action around education. We'll give you all the details after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Thank you.
of issues where the Trump administration has done virtually nothing to improve the situation of the American people is quite long, but education certainly deserves a place on there. And that was why I was very excited to see that yesterday was a National Day of Action organizing around education and education funding. And joining us now to break down what the goals of this movement are is National Director of Journey for Justice Alliance and community organizer Jeetu Brown. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you here, especially just one day after this National Day of Action. So could you tell us about what the organization was around?
Yes, sir. So Journey for Justice Alliance is also a member of a larger group called the Alliance to Reclaim Our Schools, which is a national community labor coalition that has over 7 million members. The action to yesterday was themed, We Choose Equity, So Fund Our Future. And our point is that the privatization of education, which means closing schools, the charter school industry, and school vouchers are heaped upon Black and brown communities when we haven't even met the mandate of Brown v. Board 65 years after the mandate of Brown v. Board. So what we did yesterday is we had a press event on the steps of the Supreme Court, and then we did equity bus tours in several cities around the country to show that we haven't even reached equality, let alone equity. And we know that both of those are different. So we did actions not only in Washington, D.C., but Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Chicago, Cincinnati, Ohio, Jackson, Mississippi, Birmingham, Alabama, Denver, Colorado, Sacramento, California, several cities across the United States. And then there'll be other actions coming up in the next few weeks. Either equity bus tours to show the disparities and to demand equity mandates and other local issues that people care about. And then also to call for the passage of the Keep Our Pact Act, which is a bill that's calling for full funding of Title I, which are resources that were developed during the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964, and IDEA, the Individual with Disabilities Education Act, which is supposed to provide billions of dollars in resources to schools that need them the most and young people who need them the most. And do you know that since the year 2005, America has underfunded Title I and IDEA by $580 billion? That's billion with a B.
I did not know that. That's a gigantic figure.
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, we have a lot of ground to cover in making good on that. As you were, you've got organizers, this is this movement, and you've got legislation that you're supporting. Are there any politicians who you would consider to be champions in this area that are helping to get this done?
Well, I think that's why it's appropriate to use the word movement, because John, for years Democrats have been just as bad as Republicans on public education. I always say that, Donald Trump didn't close 50 schools with the stroke of a pen in Chicago. Rahm Emanuel did. Mm-hmm. So our work has been to make it very uncomfortable for Democrats to keep supporting school privatization. And so what we've seen recently at the national level and local level is a shift in Democrats' position on public education. For example, Elizabeth Warren has indicated that if she becomes president, she will hire an educator as the U.S. Secretary of Education instead of a privatizer. And then we know recently Senator Bernie Sanders has come out with the Thurgood Marshall Plan, which is basically our education platform. But he's calling for a moratorium on charter school expansion, federal funding for charters, because the federal government is the biggest funder of the charter school industry. Also, he's calling for a full investment in sustainable community schools. And along with that, he's calling for tripling the funding for Title I and IDEA. So I think we do see a tide turning. And just the day before yesterday in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, one of our member organizations, the Education Rights Network, swept the slate for the school board election on a platform of equity and investment in public education. So we know that the public wants our public schools improved, not destroyed. So this is really about destroying the privatization movement and finally moving towards equity in public education.
So on the one hand, you're trying to make sure that you're pushing candidates on the Democratic side in the right direction, that we ideally end up with a president who has the right position and takes it seriously and prioritizes it. At the same time, I mean, that best case scenario doesn't happen for a year and a half. Do you have any hope that you can work with the current federal government? I mean, it seems like it would be difficult to come up with someone more opposed to moving in the direction away from school privatization than Betsy DeVos, but that's currently who's in office.
Yeah. So, you know, as you know, John, all power is local. So we are, Journey for Justice is a national network of grassroots community-based organizations in 34 cities. And in order to increase our local power and begin to move our equitable education policy locally, we started a campaign called the We Choose campaign, which has united education advocates and organizations across race around a 7-pillared education platform that is rooted in our local experiences. So we understand that while federal support is critical and important, that while Donald Trump may control the White House right now, he does not control our neighborhoods. And so that's why the theme of yesterday's action was We Choose Equity to fund our future.
I think that is a great strategy in education and in a number of different areas while we wait for a change in leadership to not simply ignore local and state avenues to progress as well. Gigi Brown, thank you so much for joining us and breaking down this important issue.
Thank you, John. I appreciate the platform.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much. You too.
Yes, sir.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, more guests joining us. We're going to be talking about the draconian anti-abortion bans that are sweeping across the country and an issue of racial justice that might be dogging Pete Buttigieg in the near future after this. Across the country, more and more states are passing absolutely draconian and clearly unconstitutional abortion bans. And we know, as we talked about earlier this week, right-wing media is absolutely excited about the chance that they have to fundamentally overthrow Roe v. Wade. Joining us now to break down both the passage of these laws and also where we go from here is actress on the TNT series Claws, Jen Lyon. Welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Very glad to have you here. So this issue, what is your background in working on this issue? How have you reacted to more and more of these states passing these bills?
I mean, I've reacted with tears and rage and like all the things that are, I think, normal in this situation. These bills being passed are atrocious, strategic, and maddening. Mm-hmm. My stance on it is that if a woman cannot control her own fertility, she cannot manage her life. Mm-hmm. And we are not incubators. This is, I mean, it's, it renders me speechless, which I never am. I'm just like, how is this happening? Mm-hmm. What are we doing? But I work for an organization called AS4, which is Artists for Reproductive Rights, and they work to reduce the stigma around abortion and also to fund grassroots networks that are already on the ground, like mm-hmm. Access Reproductive Care, National Network for Abortion Funds, and that's what we have to do. We have to work to, we have to take to the streets, and then we also have to work to make sure that this legislation doesn't continue. Mm-hmm.
You know, so you mentioned the stigma, and it's really interesting. It seems like we're moving in two directions at the same time where I was covering the Beto O'Rourke town hall a couple of days ago, and he's not a candidate that I support, but he was very openly saying we need to change the law to make it easier to access. Everyone should have access to them, and I can't really imagine 20 years ago a presidential candidate saying something like that.
Yeah.
It was considered controversial.
Yes.
But at the same time, on the right, they're passing bills that anti-abortion extremists thought was too extreme a couple of years ago. And so it seems like they're even more emboldened.
Yeah, I mean, and we know, I mean, the reason that there's no exceptions for incest or rape is because they want this, it's to agitate. Mm-hmm. It's so the Supreme Court will take it up. Like, they know exactly what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, I mean, do you think they're going to touch it? Do you think the Supreme Court's going to touch
Court?
It? Yeah, I
mean, typically over the past few decades, they've been really hesitant to get mm-hmm. involved in that. But I don't think that Donald Trump has been as willy-nilly as most of his actions are, I think that he has had a mission in this particular area. And I think that the people who've been putting together those lists of justices for him to consider, I think that they've done it very deliberately to get this result.
It's sweet, man.
And it seems unthinkable that after more than half a century, we would be relitigating this. But it's not unthinkable that it could be overturned. And so I wonder, from your point of view, you know, having worked in this area, what's the best case scenario? A year from now, 10 years from now, what are we pushing for?
Well, we have to keep RBG alive at any cost. Mm-hmm. That's important for us. The best case scenario is that the Supreme Court takes it up and they rely on precedent, which is what Casey versus Planned Parenthood did. I mean, it weakened the state laws, but it upheld Roe versus Wade as precedent. Mm-hmm. It's shaky though, because it's built on privacy and not on women's rights. So the best case scenario is that they take it up and they establish the same precedent that these are about equal rights. Mm-hmm. Also, I'd like, you know, the ERA to be ratified. That would be helpful.
Exactly, yeah. and thankfully, there's been a lot of great activism around that as well. As you said, the actual foundation of it is shaky. It always has been. And considering the complete contempt for any sort of precedent that the Supreme Court recently has had, it's shakier than it's been.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. And people that are like, don't freak out. Nothing's going to change. I'm like, this is actually the time to freak out. Mm-hmm. I'm going to look at the camera. We have to freak out. Mm-hmm. Let's freak out.
I think it's probably time. Get that bumper sticker. So it's interesting, sort of related to this issue. As you said, you work with, you're involved with artists who are active in these areas. Yeah. There's been this debate about possible boycotts of the states that are passing these sorts of laws. What do you think about that?
I think boycotts work. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I have a soft spot in my heart for local crews and you know, I don't want them to lose work, whatever. But when you're dealing with organizations and money, like, you have to follow the money, and like that, it counts. Mm-hmm. If people pull out, like if they are hurt in the foundation of their needs, like it works, mm-hmm. and I'm for it.
I think I saw, it might have been, Google it. It might have been Jason Bateman, I think, has pulled some sort of project.
Yeah,
from one
Kristen
of the
Wiig just did.
Kristen Wiig as well.
Yeah.
Is that considered, like, in actor circles? I'm not in those circles. Is that considered, like, radical? Is there a stigma against making, like, because I know that obviously, you know, there's entertainment that's produced here on the West Coast. There's a lot in the Atlanta area and things like that. Is that considered, like, a dangerous move to make?
No.
No?
No. I mean, we're talking about equal rights. We're talking about, I mean, this, it's not dangerous to me. Like, to me, it should be normalized. Mm-hmm. Like, of course, we won't shoot in a state that has passed these draconian laws. Like, of course. Mm-hmm. Of course we won't.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I mean, actors, we get a bad rap. They're like, just shut up and act. Like, please don't have opinions, whatever. But it's important. You have to hurt them in an industry that counts for them, or else they won't pay attention. You just have to.
Yeah, and thankfully, most actors don't seem to listen to that sort of advice to just shut up and do your job, especially when Fox News is, you know, like, they don't want you to talk, but if you played, you know, Superman 30 years ago, they're excited to have you on Fox News or whatever. Like, there's certain sort of celebrities that they're perfectly fine with having on.
That's a deep cut, and you're absolutely right.
Yeah, I liked that show back in the day.
Sure.
It's a silly move on my part in hindsight.
So,
having been involved with activism around this issue, what do you think is, like, a regular person who might be watching this, someone who's concerned about this, what should they be doing?
You can donate your time and money to organizations that are already on the ground. Mm-hmm. Access Reproductive Care, National Network of Abortion Funds. Like, there are things in place already that are helping women. You can write to your congressmen, your senators. You must. Mm-hmm. We must.
Yeah. And it also seems like, I mean, I saw an analysis when those two bills passed recently, that they showed states where there are fewer women in the state legislature are far more likely to pass these sorts of bills. And so it's got to be extremely heartening to have seen in this last cycle so much more diversity in the sorts of candidates that were winning across the country.
Our little blue wave. Mm-hmm. Didn't we do it?
Are you optimistic that that's going to continue? I know that there have been past cycles that were called the Year of the Woman, and in one way or another, they were stamped down in the next cycle.
Sure.
It seems less likely in this particular case.
It seems less likely. Also, these moves, these laws, these bills passing, seems to me there's a desperation involved. Mm-hmm. It's like a last grasp of power. Like, this is how we're going to do it. And women, I believe, won't let it happen. Mm-hmm. We will rise up and we'll get nutty.
Yeah, I think that it's probably time on a number of issues to get a bit nutty.
Yeah.
I feel the exact same way. I feel like a lot of the people who are leading these movements, they've been active in this area trying to stop women from exercising
sure.
reproductive freedom for literally decades.
Yeah.
And they see the tide changing. And so, like you said, these bills are not subtle. There's no protections.
I mean, it's a challenge, but like, it makes me wild. What do you, I shouldn't be interviewing you, it's your show, but like, what do you think?
I think that on our side, we have never prioritized the Supreme Court in the way that we do. I think that on the right, they are so focused on that. They love having senators and congressmen. They would love to have a president, but they have always been focused on getting the exact right Supreme Court justices.
Yep.
And we're just, you know, whatever. Hey, maybe we'll have Merrick Garland. Maybe we'll say, oh no, we didn't get Merrick Garland. Oh no. And we just
we're
let
so
it happen.
We're so polite.
We're too polite.
The Democrats are so polite.
Yeah. Yeah. We need to take some advice from the real world. Stop being polite
and
get real.
I'm here for it.
Yeah, because the threats are real. Thank you so much for joining us. Very glad to have you on, especially on an incredibly important issue where so much
thank
is being done.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for the swivel chair. This is hard topic, but this is nice.
Exactly. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Glad to have you on. And by the way, the new season is starting. You want to tell people where they can see?
Yes, you can watch Claws. It premieres June 9th on TNT. You should watch it. We had a great episode about abortion.
Awesome.
A lady got an abortion and it wasn't a big deal.
Oh man, imagine that future.
Yeah.
Okay, well thank you so much.
Thanks.
Glad to have you here. We're gonna take a short break. We come back, more to get to. Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg is the mayor of Long Bend, Indiana. And so that is where reporters are going. And you might imagine that as they're digging into his record, South Bend, Indiana. I'm not from Indiana, can you tell? I'm from Connecticut. But anyway, as reporters are going there and conducting investigations into his past, you might imagine that, you know, we're gonna find out folksy things about him, explaining why he might be a good potential president. And that is not actually the case. As more and more of these investigations are going on, more and more troubling details about what he did and what he especially did not do as mayor are coming to the forefront. And joining us now to talk about an investigation that he's been conducting since 2011, journalist Jeff Harrell, welcome to the Damage Report.
Hey, how you doing? Thank you for having me.
Very glad to have you here. So you've been digging into a very interesting and somewhat complex case in that area for years now. Can you explain what it is that you found?
Yeah, when I was working for the South Bend Tribune in 2011, I was first contacted by some sources of mine about this young high school student, 16-year-old high school student, a kid named Jihad Vasquez, who was found hanged on a utility tower in an unincorporated part of the county here, and just on the other side of the South Bend line. And when I read the police report, the call came in at 1:42 in the afternoon. They got there at 1:50, immediately deemed the case a suicide. Less than a half an hour later, they were at the mother's home telling her that her son had been found, And while they were at the home, the young man's body was taken to a funeral home without an autopsy, without anything. The case was closed basically that night, and his body was cremated, I don't have an exact date on the cremation, but it looks, according to the reports, it was cremated within the next 24 hours anyway. And anyway, it just seemed to me that the whole thing was really, really, really fast. And they just shoved this kid in the ground without any kind of investigation at all. And the mother I've been in contact with ever since. I mean, she's lived with this now for 8 years, and they just threw it away as a suicide.
And so, as you point out, I mean, she's been obviously bothered by this for a number of years and has wanted answers to the questions that she's had since initially. She feels, from your reporting, like she was not provided with information about what her options were. Sort of the initial period after the death where you could find out what had actually been going on was to some extent wasted by the authorities. And where Pete Buttigieg comes in is he becomes mayor within a year of the death. And so she went to him for information, and how was she received?
She was, the local NAACP here was working with her, trying to get answers for her. And nobody was telling her anything. They kept saying, it's a suicide. We know a suicide and we see one. And we're sorry about your son's death, but this is the way it's going to be. And in August of 2012, Stephanie and Tom Bush, who was the redress minister for the local NAACP, went in front of this common council here in South Bend and asking if the council could launch an investigation into her son's death. And Buttigieg was at that same meeting. He spoke at the outset of the meeting. And after the meeting, she approached him and told her, and of course he heard her, he was there during her public portion part, and he gave her his business card and said, call my office. And she called, she tells me she called several times, and every time the his secretary wouldn't put Stephanie through. So he just, basically she was ignored.
And so you've got a write-up about this that's available through TYT Investigates right now. Has the Buttigieg campaign, have they made a statement about this?
No. No, we reached out to them 2 days ago, and one of his spokesmen said he had he needed more time with this. And ironically, he said he was working on another query from the Young Turks. And But we, you know, the simple answer is no, they have not responded to the story.
And so there are a lot of details in this story. Your write-up is quite detailed, and so people should go and take a look at it. But there was one more aspect that I wanted to focus on that seems just a little bit odd. There's a lot about this story that seems odd. And one has to do with the coroner who was initially involved in this case after the death, who had apparently no medical training. And Pete Buttigieg actually gave that person a pretty significant promotion, is that correct?
Yes. Charles Hurley was a former police chief in South Bend in the 80s. His background was police work. He had no medical training. In this state, you do not need medical training to be a coroner. Welcome to Indiana. When the police tapes scandal broke, which, by the way, was my story. I broke the police tape story. You know, and but when Buttigieg demoted Daryl Boykins when the police tapes thing was going on, was first started out, he replaced Boykins with Chuck Hurley, the interim chief.
Exactly. So just an idea of the weird twists and turns in this case. And there are some really interesting details concerning items that were not found at the scene that should have been there. Different details like that certainly merit more investigation. You've been working on this for some time, and we do appreciate the work that you've done on this story. And as you pointed out, other stories that we've actually covered on this show. So Jeff Harrell, thank you so much for your work.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. We're going to take one more break here on the Damage Report. When we come back, an attempt to have Harriet Tubman on official U.S. currency runs up against Steve Mnuchin. We've got the details after this. Look at the faces on your money, you are going to see a lot of white faces. And that was why it was a very positive move just a couple of years ago back in 2016 when then Secretary of the Treasury Jack Lew announced that the $20 bill would get a new face, Harriet Tubman, one of the most iconic Americans in the history of our country. And that was supposed to be coming up pretty soon, but it's not actually going to happen apparently because Donald Trump and his Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, have different ideas. Mnuchin was recently before the Senate before the House, and Representative Ayanna Pressley was questioning him about this deadline. So take a look at what he said and also the way that he says it.
So yes or no, will you meet what was originally the 2020 redesign deadline? Yes or no?
Again, to be clear, the redesign that we are focused on at 20. No, we will meet the security feature redesign in 2020. The imagery feature will not be an issue that comes up until most likely 2026.
And I'm just wondering if you could explain that to me, because after an exhaustive community process where people who organized for quite some time, and you said you do share my sentiments and opinion that our currency should be more reflective of the contributions and the diversity of those contributions. Why the delay?
No, I didn't say that the currency should be reflected.
Well, you said imagery.
I said imagery, not referring to currency.
Okay, so do you believe that? Do you support Harriet Tubman being on the $20 bill?
I've made no decision as it relates to that, and that decision won't be made in as I said,
but there was a community process.
26.
There was a national, there was a community process.
Again, it's a decision of the Secretary of the Treasury. Right now, my decision is focused on security features.
Exactly. He has different priorities there. And what you saw there, where he's trying to pretend that, oh no, I'm so swamped with all this security stuff. You know, we need like 8 years to redo the image part of it, something that I'm pretty sure our graphics department can mock up later today if we needed to. That is the sort of incredibly petty racism that has become all too common in our government recently. You've got like high level racism institutionalized, like black people not being able to get loans for housing for a half century longer. And then you have just, you know what? It would bother me to see Harriet Tubman's face on there. And I love Andrew Jackson, who she's going to replace. And so I'm simply not going to allow it. So Steve Mnuchin, angel of petty racism. But great work by Ayanna Pressley by pressing the issue and laying out the history of how we got to the point where we're supposed to have in just 2 years this redesign, and apparently I'm not going to. She tweeted about it afterwards saying, people other than white men built this country, and Secretary Mnuchin agrees, yet he refuses to update our currency. Harriet Tubman, Marian Anderson, Eleanor Roosevelt are iconic Americans, and it's past time that our money reflects that. Hashtag representation matters. And in this particular case, I mean, it is hard to come up with someone who better deserves to be, like, not specifically on the money, but seen and for people to know about her contributions. Tubman was born into slavery, escaped, and then returned to the South, where she led other slaves to freedom. She was a Union scout during the Civil War and later advocated women's voting rights. Andrew Jackson, on the other hand, the current resident of the $20 bill, orchestrated the removal of Native Americans from lands to the east of the Mississippi River and sent them marching west on the so-called Trail of Tears. He was the architect of one of the lowest moments in our nation's history. He was a guy that was genocidally against some of the most victimized groups in American history, and he still has that spot. And this iconic, inspirational figure, can't really have her there. And if it seems like, why are you focusing on money? Like, this sort of representation matters, imagery matters. And very recently, just a couple of days ago, an image went viral on the internet that I think demonstrates this pretty well. Take a look at this Instagram post. And you're seeing there, the caption says, Lovey meets Harriet. There's a mural of Harriet Tubman done there. And you see a little girl walking up and holding hands with the image there. An image that you can see, thankfully, in murals like this, but not on the images that you carry around with you literally every day. And the gatekeeping on those sorts of common images is petty, but also consequential for representation. When we're talking about official images of the US government, Mnuchin not so interested, and Donald Trump certainly not interested, especially when it comes to protecting Andrew Jackson. Mr. Trump has frequently described Jackson, whose portrait hangs in the Oval Office, as a populist hero who reminds him of himself. 2 months into his presidency, Trump stopped to lay a wreath at Jackson's tomb at the Hermitage, his plantation in Nashville, and Trump said, it was during the revolution that Jackson first confronted and defied an arrogant elite. Does that sound familiar? Yes, arrogant elites definitely sound familiar. We've still got them in DC, literally to today. And by the way, I just want one last ironic sort of twist to this. Obviously, you have Harriet Tubman, who totally deserves the position. You have Andrew Jackson, who I would love to see banished from currency, let alone, you know, other things like that. But in particular, Jackson was opposed to the issuance of paper money by state and national banks. He only trusted gold and silver as currency and shut down the Second Bank of the United States in part because of its ability to manipulate paper money. And so a case could be made that his presence on paper money is an insult to his memory. And that is the only silver lining in this entire story, actually. Anyway, ridiculous. Hopefully this will be resolved, and hopefully before 2026 or 2028. Anyway, thank you everybody who's watching. It's a big show today. Thank you for sticking with it. We've got one more to close out the week with Brent Ehrlich tomorrow. So we will see you then. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.